Radio EcoShock.
This speech was recorded by Alex Smith at the University of British Columbia, April 9th, courtesy of the Vancouver Institute. Here is the short introduction by the Honorable Madam Justice Mary Newberry, followed by the new big picture on climate change by Bill McKibben.
Well, as Peter said, this is the last lecture of the 95th year of free public lectures at the Vancouver Institute. Tonight, our series will end on a high note with the Irving K. Barber Center Lecture. Professor Bill McKibben is an American environmentalist and writer. He is one of the founders of Step It Up, a grassroots environmental campaign to demand action on global warming by the U.S. Congress. He is also the head of 350.org, an international environmental organization focused on uniting the world around solutions to the climate crisis. Professor McKibben grew up in the suburbs of Lexington, Massachusetts. After completing his undergrad work at Harvard, he joined The New Yorker as a staff writer. After spending several years with the magazine, he quit when its longtime editor, William Shawn, was forced out of his job in the late 80s and moved to the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York. He has continued to contribute to a number of publications, including The New York Times, The Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, The National Geographic, Rolling Stone, and Outside. His first book, The End of Nature, was published in 1989. It is widely regarded as the first book to warn the general public about the threat of climate change. Since then, he has written a number of books relating to man's relationship with the natural world. In The Comforting Whirlwind, God, Job, and the Scale of Creation, published in 1994, he uses the biblical story of Job to comment on modern society's hubris and neglect of the environment. In Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, published in 2007, he addresses the shortcomings of the growth economy and envisions a transition to more local-scale enterprise. In his most recent book, Earth, with two A's, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, he takes the position that we have already passed the tipping point for dramatic climate change. The world in which we have flourished for most of human history is gone. It is my pleasure to introduce Professor McKibben, who will be speaking to us about survival on a rapidly changing planet. Thank you.
Peter, thank you so much for having me here. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. It may be more of a pleasure for me than for you. I feel particularly in sort of, I've actually had a wonderful day here in Vancouver and ended with a beautiful hike up, where were we? Up West Canyon and down East Canyon, and then a visit into the incredibly beautiful Nitobe Garden, is that what it's called? The Asian garden under the cherry blossoms and your tree. It makes me feel even worse than usual about my role as a kind of professional bummer-outer of people. I apologize in advance to you for my remarks tonight. And I'll try to end on a relatively hopeful note, but we are going to go through the valley for a moment first, because, look, climate change is by far the biggest thing that human beings have ever done, by far, and it's worth, though you know the outlines of it, just to be reminded every once in a while of exactly where we are and exactly what the implications are. I did write the first book for a general audience about climate change back in 1989, so I guess 22 years ago now. We knew most of what we needed to know 22 years ago. We knew that when you burn coal and gas and oil, you put carbon into the atmosphere. And we knew that the molecular structure of CO2 trapped heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. The only thing we didn't know was how quickly this was going to pinch and how hard. And the story of the last two decades is it's pinching a lot faster and a lot harder than we had thought, even in our gloomiest preoccupations. That's what this last book with the strange title was about. And I won't bother listing at infinite end the proofs adduced in that book, the first chapter of which, I warn you, if you read it, is grim tough going. It's a kind of series of sharp uppercuts demonstrating just how powerfully we've managed to knock most of the world's physical systems off kilter, things that 20 years ago we didn't imagine were even possibilities, like changing the chemistry of seawater, lowering its pH, turning it 30% more acid simply because it's absorbing so much CO2 from the atmosphere. I could list these for a very long time, trust me. I'm not going to. I'll just talk about what's happened in the years since that book came out, because the last 12 months provide illustration enough of precisely what's going on. 2010 was the warmest year for which we have records. 19 nations set new all-time temperature records last year. Some of those records were extreme. I was telling people yesterday about talking to our 350.org colleagues in Pakistan in June one day. We were just on the phone making plans, and one of them said, "It's very hot here today." And I was surprised to hear him say it. It's usually hot in Pakistan in June. No one would remark. He said, "No, it's really hot. We just set the new all-time Asia temperature record. It was 129 degrees Fahrenheit." Okay. When you have heat like that, all kinds of things happen. You're privy to some of it as you look north in Canada. The Arctic has continued its precipitous melt. Sometimes I think it's such an enormous effect that it's almost hard for us to see it simply because of its size. Go back and find one of those pictures that came back from Apollo 8. You remember those first pictures of the Earth as viewed from outer space 40 years ago. Those were beautiful pictures, and they are as out of date as my high school yearbook photo, you know. There is about 40% less sea ice in the Arctic than there was then. That's an astonishing change in a basic physical parameter. Last year was the year of perhaps the greatest melt yet. Both the Northwest and Northeast passages were open. People had a yacht race around territory that even 10 years ago we thought no human would ever navigate. And of course, the effects of that on the surrounding land are enormous as that tundra begins to thaw and the methane beneath it begins to leak into the atmosphere, and as one of the great ecosystems of the entire world begins to unravel. In fact, more than begins, unravels with astonishing speed. Across the world, in Russia, last summer they had a heat wave of epic proportion. It had never reached 100 degrees in Moscow. It was above 100 degrees for 8 straight days in the beginning of August, and that was enough not only to cause enormous forest fires and peat bog fires, it was enough to really scare the Kremlin. Their drought was severe enough that they decided to stop all grain export to the rest of the world. Russia's the third biggest grain exporter on the planet. Within weeks, the price of grain around the world had gone up about 70%, which means that there are lots and lots and lots of people tonight not eating anywhere near as much as they would like to be eating for dinner because they can't afford it. Maybe the thing that became clearest last year and sort of scariest of all was just how massively we've managed to screw up the hydrological cycle, the way that water moves around the planet. The physics of this are quite simple. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold. Okay? Therefore, the Earth's atmosphere is 4.5% moister than it was 40 years ago on average. That's an astonishingly large change in a very basic parameter of the Earth. One of the first things you'd want to know if you arrived at a different planet, you know, one of the first things that if, you know, Mr. Spock had arrived on a new planet with what it was, tricorder or whatever he called it, you know, to find out what was going on this new amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is pretty basic. Well, there's a lot more of it, which loads the dice for deluge and downpour and flood. And now, year after year, but especially last year, the dice are beginning to come up snake eyes for place after place after place. You saw those pictures recently of the huge floods in Queensland. Similar things in the last few months in Sri Lanka, in Vietnam, in the part of Brazil northeast of Rio. Most powerfully last year in Pakistan. That country up and around the Khyber Pass, which normally sees about 3 feet of rain in a year, saw 12 feet of rain in a week. That swelled the Indus River so much that before it had completely drained, a quarter of the country was underwater. There are still 4 million people homeless in Pakistan as a result. Almost unbelievable to watch. And one of the things to bear in mind, and this is something I may repeat in the course of the evening, one of the things to bear in mind is nobody in Pakistan did a darn thing to cause that problem. There's an almost inverse relationship between how quickly you're being damaged by climate change and how much of the trouble you're responsible for. So it is not only a practical issue of the highest order, it is a moral issue and an ethical challenge of the highest order. It's also a very basic, practical survival issue for all of us because the scientists assure us that it's going to get worse. So far, human beings have raised the temperature of the planet about 1 degree. We've added about 3/4 of a watt per square meter of the Earth's surface of extra solar energy. That's been enough to cause the changes that we've so far seen. There's probably about another degree Celsius in the pipeline from carbon we've already emitted. It takes a while for it to fully express that heat in the atmosphere because the oceans hold it for a while. But we're thinking there's another degree already in the pipeline. What the climatologists tell us is, unless we get our act together very quickly, and by getting our act together, I mean ceasing to burn coal and gas and oil far more quickly than governments or economic actors at the moment are planning to do it, unless we get our act together very, very quickly in the next few years, the climatologists are robust in their consensus that 1 and 2 degrees will be 4 or 5 degrees before the century is out, taking us way beyond not just anything we've known in human history, we're already probably past that, but to temperatures much higher than any time before the beginning of primate evolution, a completely different planet. If 1 degree melts the Arctic, we do not want to find out what 4 degrees will do. Everything that we can predict about it is deadly, including the fact that our main crops on which we survive don't do well when the temperature gets markedly higher than it is now. They've evolved for this world too. The new data from Stanford and the University of Washington would indicate that we could expect reductions in grain yields of 40 or 50% if the temperature goes up 4 or 5 degrees. That alone would be enough to make the world, the civilizations that we've built on it, impossible. For 10,000 years, we've built civilizations in a time of benign stability, what a period that scientists call the Holocene. We've managed in very short order to bring the Holocene to an end. The only question now is how chaotic and how crazy the world to come will be, and it depends entirely on how swiftly and bravely we move to do something about that problem, and something big, not something around the edges, but a central transformation of our energy economy. Okay, we're through the worst, and you can take a breath. I apologize. First thing I want you to understand, science has done its job and done it remarkably well. The scientific method the dialectic that we're used to, took this extraordinarily difficult problem in physics and chemistry, and in the relatively short order, a decade or a little more, managed to reduce it to a workable consensus. This Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change produced a working consensus that is plenty to tell us where we need to go. Second, the engineering method has worked pretty well, too. 20 years ago, when we talked about solar power or wind power, we kind of did it with our fingers crossed because it wasn't ready yet. You know, it was still kind of something that we sort of hoped would happen. Well, it's happened in many ways. The fastest growing form of electric generation around the world is wind, although it starts from such a small base that we need to make it go up much faster if it's going to make a huge dent in this problem. But we know how to do it. The technology increasingly is there. The scientific method worked. The engineering method worked. As well as they worked, that's how badly the political method has failed over that same period, okay? As a civilization and as nations, we have managed to do essentially nothing so far, nothing that really matters. BC has come as close as any place on the planet to actually beginning to take some small steps along this regard. The carbon tax and things were at least beginnings of some idea about how one might begin to respond. But that's the biggest step anyone's taken in the world gives you some idea of how feebly we've moved to address the biggest thing that's ever happened. The U.S., the chief source of this problem, responsible for almost 40% of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere historically, has had a 20-year bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing at all, and it has succeeded admirably. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 240-178 to defeat a resolution saying that global warming was real and a problem, okay? Writing their own, I guess, sort of imagining that because they're allowed to amend the tax law and the penal code and things, that they're also allowed to amend the laws of nature, that they get their own physics and chemistry, but you don't, and that's the problem. The question becomes how to change that, what to do, how to make that kind of transformational change happen in the very short time that physics and chemistry is allowing us. Talk about for the rest of the evening, and I'll try to do it as quickly as I can. But I want to begin by saying that as I do, I leave the realm of the hard and factual. Everything I've told you so far, I can footnote, but we go into the realm of talking about movement building and politics and things. There are no hard and fast rules, and no one is an expert, and that's particularly true of me. Though I've spent the last few years trying to build these big movements, it's not my character. I'm a writer. Given my druthers, much as I like you all, I'd really rather be in my room typing, you know? We're sort of self-selected against one. I mean, if we could communicate effectively in other ways, we wouldn't be writers. We'd be normally socialized human beings, you know? It would be okay. But the reason that I sort of started doing this was at some point I realized that all the writing in the world that I was doing was getting very little done. I remember being on a trip to Bangladesh, incredibly beautiful place, one of my favorite places on earth, incredibly fertile and though crowded, 140 million people in an area the size of the American state of Wisconsin, nonetheless able to feed itself. Because it's so fertile and productive. But they're in big trouble. I mean, the Bay of Bengal is rising. The glaciers at the head of the Ganges and the Brahmaputra are dwindling. Over time, they'll be in serious trouble. When I was there, the trouble they were having, however, was not chronic. It was acute. They were having their first big outbreak of a disease called dengue fever. All right. Mosquito-borne disease spreading like wildfire across Asia and South America. The incidence up about 200% in the last decade because that mosquito, Aedes aegypti, dearly loves the warm, wet world that we're building for it. In fact, It's occurred to me from time to time that if you were watching our planet through a telescope and trying to figure out what on earth they were doing down there, why they were changing the atmospheric composition, a reasonable hypothesis would be that we had embarked on a kind of planet-wide mosquito ranching operation, you know, that was our plan, you know. But they were having this outbreak of dengue, and it was getting tons. It was the only story in the news because it was new, and there were lots of people dying. I spent a lot of time in the slums there, so eventually I got bit by the wrong mosquito. I was as sick as I'd ever been, but of course I didn't die because I was strong and healthy going in. I remember going down to the hospital ward, and it was a room bigger than this, and there's lines of people lying on cots and shivering, and people on the floor in between because there weren't enough cots. And as I stood there looking at them, the main thought I was having, besides, boy, do I not feel good, the other main thought I was having was, boy, is this unfair. Those 140 million people, when the UN tries to measure how much carbon each country in the world emits, you can't get a number for Bangladesh. It's a rounding error in the calculations. Those of you who've been there know that the bicycle rickshaw is still the main means of transit, that most people aren't connected to the electric grid. They're not causing the problem, but they're suffering from it. And when I got back home, I wanted to do something more than write, but I had no idea what to do. I'm a writer. I live in Vermont, the second smallest state in the union. I'm out in the woods. I don't know how to do it. I called up a few of my writer friends on the phone in Vermont and I said, here's what we're going to do. We'll go up to our main city, which is called Burlington. It's only 50,000 people, so it's not that main, but it's as good as we got, you know. And we'll go up there and we're going to sit in on the steps of the federal building and we will be arrested and there'll be a little story in the paper and at least we will have done something. And these guys were as clueless as, oh, that's a good plan. Let's do that, you know. But one of them happily called up to the police in Burlington. What'll happen if we carry out this intrepid stunt, you know? And the police said, nothing will happen. Stay there as long as you want, you know. So we had to recalculate, you know, and I just sent out emails to everybody and said, we're going to go for a walk. And we left 2 weeks later from Robert Frost's old summer writing cabin up in the Green Mountains, because he's kind of our patron saint in Vermont, you know. And we hiked for 5 days along the road, and we slept in farm fields at night. Now, I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, so I'd called up all the Methodist churches en route to make sure that there would be potluck suppers, kind of sort of the Methodist sacrament would be available, you know, as we walked. And it was great. And we got to Burlington and there were 1,000 people marching. Now, y'all are citizens of a great and sophisticated metropolis. So to you, 1,000 people is nothing at all. But in Vermont, with the possible exception of University of Vermont hockey games, it is as many people as ever assemble. I mean, it's a big, the cows were running in terror from the fence line as we went by. And it was enough to get all our candidates for office to come and meet with us down by the shore of Lake Champlain. You guys are in the middle of election right now, so they all came down, and they not only came down, they signed this piece of cardboard we'd been carrying hither and yon across the countryside that said, if I'm elected, I'll work to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050, which at the time was a very radical proposition endorsed only by scientists, not by politicians. But they all signed, and not just the Liberal Democrats, you know, the conservative Republicans. The woman who was running on the Republican ticket for Congress and who almost won had said 2 months before, I'm not sure global warming is real. More research needs to be done. Well, it turned out that the more research that needed to be done was on the topic, how many people will walk across Vermont and ask me to change my mind? And empirically, 1,000 was sufficient, you know, because she signed. That's good. That's the way it's supposed to work. We were pleased. The only thing we weren't pleased was to open the newspaper the next morning and see this story that said that 1,000 people was likely the largest demonstration about climate change that had yet taken place in the United States. And when we saw that, we said, huh, no wonder we're losing. We have the superstructure of a movement. We've got Al Gore. We've got policy experts, we've got economists, we've got scientists. The only part of the movement that we somehow forgot was the movement part. There's nothing there to give it any kind of heft, you know? And maybe we can figure out how to do this. When I say we, I mean me and seven undergraduates at Middlebury College, where I teach in Vermont. They were seniors, so they weren't done with college, but they were pretty much done with college, if you know what I mean. And we set to work, and we didn't have any money, but we just sent out emails to people saying, do this same sort of thing on this day in April all around the country. And it turned out that there were lots of people around America who had already changed their light bulbs and already figured out that that was not going to solve this problem. They were suffering, as we always all do, from the same worry, that in the face of this enormous problem, we're so small and our efforts are so insignificant, what point could there be? But the mere prospect of doing the same thing on the same day all over the country was kind of tonic to people. And so 3 months later in April, we managed, much to our surprise, to pull off 1,400 sort of simultaneous demonstrations across the country. And 2 days later, both candidate Clinton and candidate Obama endorsed this 80% by 2050 cut. And we were feeling, I believe the technical word would be smug, you know, about our success. The trouble was that 6 weeks later, in the summer of 2007, was when the Arctic really began to melt for the first time. The accelerated melt became suddenly very obvious, and a lot of other things were starting to happen too. I mean, I started getting phone calls from scientists I'd known for a quarter century. Now, these folks had always been worried, but all of a sudden, they really were panicked. I mean, they were calling at 1 a.m. This is off the charts. Things are going. By the time the summer was over, a couple of things were clear. Our old targets were obsolete and out of date. What happens in 2050 is of much less interest than what happens in 2020. And it became pretty clear that not only were we not going to work one light bulb at a time, we weren't going to be able to do this one country at a time. At some level, it was going to have to be one planet at a time or not. This is the first issue that's ever really been like that, where the entire world is both affected and involved. And that was a daunting realization because, you know, people don't do much global organizing because the world is a big place and everyone insists on speaking their own language. And where do you even start, you know? We were horrified and thrilled in January of 2008 when our foremost climatologist in the world, the NASA scientist Jim Hansen and his team, produced a paper, one of the most important scientific papers of the millennia. And what they said was, we now know enough about carbon in the atmosphere from looking at not only real-time observations of things like Arctic melt, but also at the reams of paleoclimatic data that we've managed to analyze from ice cores and things. We now know enough to say how much carbon in the atmosphere is too much. In fact, they said, any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than 350 parts per million was not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. Okay? That's strong language for scientists to use. And it's a lot stronger language when you realize that outside today, in Vancouver and Vienna and Vietnam and every place else, the atmosphere is 390 parts per million CO2. We're already way too high. It's going up about 2 parts per million per year because we've burned so much coal and gas and oil. That's why the Arctic is melting. And so it was horrifying to read that paper because it let us understand at some visceral level for the first time that there was no way we were going to stop global warming, prevent it from happening. It was already, as we could tell by watching the Arctic melt, but just in the most basic scientific terms, it was well underway. All right, so horrifying, a kind of wake-up call for our species. But as organizers, it seemed to us like it was a kind of useful thing to have this number, because it dawned on us that Arabic numerals are the one thing that do go around the world easily, that they work the same way wherever you are, you know. You wouldn't normally choose a wonky scientific data point, 350 parts per million CO2, as your rallying cry. It lacks, you know, it's sort of not like I have a dream or something like that, you know. But it does have this virtue of being able to go anywhere. And so we decided we'd see what we could do. And that was a good advantage. We needed some advantages. We had some others. These seven kids had now graduated from college, so there were no more papers and exams and things. That was good. And there are seven continents, so that matched up nicely. Each one took one. The guy who took the Antarctic had to take the internet, you know, also, because it's sort of its own continent. And off we set to organize. And what we found all over the world were that there were lots of people, young people especially, who understood what was going on. Now, most of them were not thinking of themselves as environmentalists. In large part of the world, there aren't really a kind of category called environmentalists. But these were people who were working hard on public health and keeping people in their communities healthy, on food and making sure there was enough to eat, and people on social justice of all kinds, and war and peace, and on women's issues. Working on all the things that won't happen if we completely destabilize the planet. Working on all the things that aren't happening right now in Pakistan, because everybody's so busy trying to make sure that there's a tarp over people's heads, you know. We did these training camps for young people, one in Turkey for Central Asia, one in the Caribbean, one in Johannesburg. We brought a couple of kids from each country in Africa down. Most had never been on an airplane before, but they instantly understood what we were getting at, and we had a week of organizing, and then they fanned out back across the country to go to work in their own places. We didn't hear much from them because the internet's still pretty notional across much of that. You can't just Skype people all the time, but we knew they were working. We didn't know how well this would come together because we were doing it without money or resources or big organizations or things, but we got the idea that this might perhaps going to work 2 days before the big day we'd set. We told everybody to do something on October 24th, 2009. On October 22nd, we were sitting in our little office in downtown New York, and we got a phone call. And it was from one of these girls that we'd worked with. She is 18 in Ethiopia, in Addis Ababa. And she said, she was in tears. She said, the government took away our permit for Saturday. Organizer's worst nightmare, you know, and it's like, so we can't do it. So we're doing it today before they can stop us. We're so sorry. We don't want to jump the gun. We were so looking forward to doing it with everybody else. We hope we don't spoil it for everybody else. And there are 15,000 people right now out in the street in Addis Ababa chanting 350. And we were like, don't worry about the date. That's good. And after that, it was just insane. For the next, 48 hours, the pictures just came in from, the next one came from American servicemen in Afghanistan. They'd made a 350 with sandbags. They sent a note saying, we're parking our Humvee for the weekend and walking. Okay. By the time it was done, there'd been 5,100 of these in 180 countries. CNN said it was the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. And I just want to show, I'm just going to show you pictures, a few real fast. Here's the one thing I really, really want you to see when you look at these. These are what, for those of you who are interested in working on these things, these are what your colleagues look like around the world. And for those of you who just are sort of interested in stuff, the lesson I took from them, and I hope you take, is, if nothing else from this talk, that this old canard that environmentalism is something for rich white people who have taken care of their other problems is a lie. Almost everyone we work with around the world is poor, black, brown, Asian, and young, because, frankly, almost everyone around the world falls into those categories, okay? And oddly enough, they're just as interested in the future as anybody else. In fact, they may be more interested because the future bears down on them somewhat harder than it bears down on those of us still a little insulated by wealth. So there were pictures coming from places we'd never heard of. There were 300 big demonstrations in India. There were places coming from people we couldn't identify, you know, where they were. Places that were extraordinarily poor. These are dugout canoes on the Congo River, someplace above Kinshasa. They lacked a digital camera. They tried to develop it in their darkroom. It didn't come out so well, so they had to write in what their banner had said. But just the fact that they were there and that somehow a T-shirt had made it, you know, out into the middle of, that was seemed to us a good sign. And there were 15,000 of these in our Flickr account, if you want to go look. I wanted to show this one from Istanbul because I just had a wonderful interview before we started with a journalist from the terrific progressive radio station in Istanbul that helped us organize there and did a remarkable job. There were six big demonstrations in Istanbul. There were beautiful, beautiful creative displays from the Space Needle. That's the colors of the Venezuelan flag. Just place after place after place. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. Big involvement of religious communities. Really for the first time in something like this, we'd had good luck with prelates of all kinds. In fact, one of the things that made our organizing go really well across a large swath of the world was that 2 weeks beforehand, the patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church, Bartholomew, leader of 400 million Eastern Christians, and as it turns out, a fairly plain-spoken patriarch, had given a sermon in which he said, and I quote, "Global warming is a sin and 350 is an act of redemption." That helped. That's the head of Muslim South Africa, the head of kind of native traditions. Behind them, Archbishop Tutu's successor is the Anglican Archbishop of South Africa at the head of a huge multi-faith march. It's a Pentecostal school someplace. That's the most important evangelical college in the U.S. where Billy Graham went to school. Even a few years ago, there would not have been an environmental. They would have been viewed as sort of suspiciously pagan or something. It's a very good sign that it's now moved well into those communities, and they've become some of the best backers of this work any place in the world. I'd been to Bethlehem to do a little organizing. The Dead Sea is shrinking very dramatically as the planet warms. People there wanted to do something, but it's not an easy place to organize because there's military checkpoints and walls and everything all over the place. So the Jordanians said, okay, we'll do the three on our shore. Palestinians said, we're good for the five in Palestine. The Israelis said, we'll make the zero. It was really, really beautiful. And it was a sort of good sign of people putting aside some of their other differences, you know, for a little while to concentrate on those problems that unite us. We did a lot of that kind of global scale scrabble everywhere, and we had lots of fun, and it was everywhere, including here. And I'm really grateful to the people who helped us in Vancouver and Victoria and all sorts of other places do really, and I wish I'd found the pictures to put them in, but they're easy to find. I showed this picture yesterday, and I'll tell the story just because I like it. These in Soweto, a heartland of resistance to apartheid, they did 350 bungee jumps. But they sent us a note saying, we strung the line between the cooling towers of a defunct coal-fired power plant. This is the highest and best use for coal-fired power going forward. You know. That's my daughter is in the middle of that. Those are sap buckets because we're losing our maple forest pretty fast. 300 big demonstrations across China. Now, one of them did get busted up by the police, but the other 290-some went off. That's the China Youth Climate Network, and behind them, they're making a human wind turbine. If you look closely, you can see the world's largest wind farm in Inner Mongolia. Big help from all over the world, from unlikely places. That was the smallest demonstration and one of the most beautiful. She started out with a ton of her friends, and they had to go through about six U.S. military checkpoints, and not surprisingly, most of them got scared eventually and left. But she wanted to go on Ola to the side of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and she's just great. She's one of my... We brought her to Copenhagen later, and fantastic. The Maldives... If there's any country in the world that's engaged in this fight, it's the Maldives, a paradisical country in the Indian Ocean, entirely Muslim, incredibly beautiful. Highest point in the 1,200-island archipelago is about a meter and a half above sea level. Okay, Their Student Government Association held this meeting in the lagoon to demonstrate their plight. The government itself, led by its wonderful president, Mohamed Nasheed, he trained all his cabinet to scuba dive so that they could hold an underwater cabinet meeting on their dying coral reef and pass this resolution to send to the UN demanding action on this 350 target, okay? And they're not just doing political action. This not very rich country has announced that it will be the first entirely carbon neutral nation in the world by 2020. And they are putting up windmills and things just as fast as possibly they can from one end to the other. It should shame us to some degree to watch this happening in places like that. Just a magnificent day of all kinds. We took over Times Square and flashed thousands of these pictures on those big jumbotrons that are normally advertising vodka and things. And it was great. We wanted to show the New York media. We also wanted to take pictures of those pictures and send them back to people in the Congo and say, look, this is what you look like 50 feet tall, and you are a big part of a big movement. It got extraordinary media coverage. It was the lead story on Google News for about 36 hours because there were more sources linking to it of new newspapers and TV coverage and stuff than any topic on the planet. And I think the biggest reason was just because support was coming from such unlikely places and from people to whom our eyes do not look like environmentalists. Those guys, you know, those are some oil-rich sheikhs in their oil-rich sheikhdom, but they're smart oil-rich sheikhs. Behind them is the edge of the world's largest solar array, you know. They're figuring out what's up and what's coming. Mostly just these vast things happening in places we had never heard of. And there were also, I confess, a large portfolio of slides grouped together in a file called 350 Adorable. And they really were adorable. And they're also really painful to look at. There were a lot of refugees in the last bloody century we just came through. But you couldn't tell in 1911, you couldn't say who the refugees were going to be 40 years hence, you know. You couldn't predict how history was going to go. You can predict with some accuracy that those girls will be refugees by the time they're in middle age. No fault of their own. I wish I could tell you that all this had carried the day. It obviously didn't. We got to Copenhagen 6 weeks later with a lot of momentum. That was really good. We convinced 117 nations to sign on to this 350 target. That was pretty good. We were, you know, I mean, we started with 7 college kids and no money, and we felt 170 was good. The trouble is, of course, they were the wrong 117. They were the poorest nations in the planet, the richest and most addicted, led by the countries of North America, refused to do a damn thing, wouldn't bite the bullet, wouldn't take any action, did everything they could figure out how to do to walk away from it. And so that meeting collapsed. 6 months later, the U.S. Senate refused to even take a vote on the most tepid and moderate and tame of climate bills. I was worried this whole movement would just kind of collapse in despair. It hasn't, happily. We had another big day of action last October, and it turned out to be bigger than this one. We did a global work party. This time people were building things, solar panels, bike paths, community gardens. It was pretty great. There were 7,400 of these work parties in 189 countries, every country on Earth but North Korea. It was grand. And still, of course, not enough, not anywhere near enough. We're just beginning to figure out how we're going to do this. There'll be another one of these global days of action this year, and we need your help. It'll be on September 24th. Circle it on your calendar. Go to 350.org for more information. It'll be beautiful. It'll be based around motion. And there'll be people on bicycles in places all over the world. Other things too, but a lot of bikes, because bikes are one of those few tools that both rich and poor on this planet use, you know. But we're under no illusions that that is enough. What's become clear over the last few years is that the goal, the technique that we're going to use to win this isn't what we thought it was. It isn't enough merely to provide our leaders with information about what's going wrong and how they might solve it. They know that by now, and they're doing nothing. And the reason that they're doing nothing is because of the financial might of the fossil fuel industry, which has been enough to stall any kind of progress. And when I say financial might, I mean it. This is the human activity that has produced more money than any other, is the discovery, refinement and combustion of fossil fuels. ExxonMobil made more money last year than any company in the history of money. Okay? In our political systems, especially in the United States, a little bit of money like that is enough to stall action for a long time. And that's what they've achieved. And until we can take them on, we're going to lose. So we're trying to be a little tougher. We're having a big campaign across the United States this year to take on the single most powerful lobby in the United States that's blocking action. It's a group called the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Okay, it's not like your local Chamber of Commerce. Those are my town. The local Chamber of Commerce supervises the Chili Festival. They do an excellent job at it. Okay. We like them. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce isn't like that. It claims to speak for all American business, and in fact, they have these foreign subsidiaries, the American Chamber of Commerce in Thailand or China, and I think in Canada as well. They claim to speak for all businesses, but in fact, 55% of their budget came from 16 companies. Now, they don't have to tell anybody who those companies are, but it's darn easy to figure out who they must be, because their main legislative agenda is making sure that the planet warms up as fast as it possibly can. They've lobbied against every even modest attempt to do anything, and they've done it in the most strident terms. Last year, they filed a brief with the Environmental Protection Agency saying that they should not regulate carbon because in the event that the planet did warm, humans would be able to adapt their behavior and physiology in order to deal with the warmer planet. Not that their 16 blessed companies should adapt their business plan to a world that ran on sun and wind, but that all human beings for all time should adapt their physiology to deal with this problem. It's unclear to me even what they have in mind, you know, grow gills. I don't know, but it's crazy. And if someone came up to you on the street in Vancouver and told you that their plan for dealing with global warming was that you would adapt your physiology, you would step around them in the street and go on. But if they had $200 million in their back pocket, you know, then it might be enough to persuade you, if you were a political leader, to think and do otherwise. And that's what's happening. And it's, I'm afraid, not only what's happening in America, but though I understand the situation less perfectly here, I think to some degree it must be what's happening in Canada as well. Now, I'm going to apologize in advance right here, because I'm going to speak frankly. In the way that sometimes people who are leaving town the next day can speak frankly, okay? I have an enormous love for Canada. I spent my elementary school years in Toronto. That's where I went to school. And moving back to the States after 4 or 5 years was in many ways a great shock. And I've always kept in the back of my mind my memories of Canada and contrasted its deep and strong community ties, its somewhat less individualistic culture, its quite remarkable institutions, kept them in my mind as a kind of reminder of what's possible and of many of the ways that the U.S. had gone off the rails. And so it is really painful to look north and see Canada behaving in really damaging, really dangerous ways. the confluence of things that are happening in Canada right now, and some of them in British Columbia, the endless fracking for natural gas so that you can send it to the tar sands to allow them to cook up those tar sands so they can get them liquid and put them in a pipeline and send them back to British Columbia and put them on a tanker and send them someplace to get burnt. There is no more effective way in the world to produce carbon emissions than that. The tar sands have become the single great source of carbon emissions, or one of them, in the entire world. There's enough carbon in there to warm the planet a degree, perhaps, all by itself. And now, the increasing willingness to take not only Canada's coal reserves, but also perhaps to build the infrastructure to let the coal, enormous coal reserves in Montana and Wyoming, make their way here to the ports to be sent to Asia. You're becoming drug dealers of the most dangerous substance on the planet right now. And the fact that it's happening more or less without much debate and controversy, I mean, I know that there are plenty of you who are working hard on this. I've spent the last couple of days with great activists led by my friend Seth Klein at the Center for Policy Alternatives and learning all kinds of stuff about what people are doing. But I also opened the newspaper today and read the stories about the election saying that these things aren't even issues, that people aren't really raising them, that they're not important to Canada's electorate. This is, more than anything that's happened in the history of Canada, going to be its legacy to the rest of the world and to the rest of history. If you pour that carbon into the atmosphere, there is no way that we can balance the atmospheric books and keep the temperature at a place that it's possible to work. And so we really, really, really need you getting involved. And I want to go say one more thing that might sound the tiniest bit rude. And I don't mean it to, because you've done an amazing job on this, in this city and on this campus, of making it a real showpiece in a lot of ways. There are great things happening. There are beautiful, efficient buildings. And Vancouver has done remarkable things. That's good. Keep doing it. But don't spend all your time gilding the lily and perfecting every last thing here, because this isn't a problem that we can solve one place at a time. I wish it were. If it were, I would stay home in Vermont, where I love, and I would happily watch what y'all were doing in this neat place. But you know what? You can build the best local agricultural system that the world's ever seen in British Columbia, and if it doesn't rain for 30 days or it rains every day for 30 days, you won't grow anything. You can't escape the world here. So take some of that energy that's being poured into all these great and wonderful and beautiful things, and also use it to engage nationally and internationally with this problem. Join in fights like 350.org so that you can leverage some of that energy beyond Vancouver to join in with the rest of the world. That sounds so, I don't mean at all to sound harsh, and I say it only because I know that this is one of those places where people do have the will and the empathy to get to work and to make an enormous, enormous difference. It's been my privilege the last few years to just go around and around the world spewing carbon behind me, there is no doubt. Talking to people, helping people organize, get going on all of this, and always for me, incredible. Well, what an incredible privilege always to be in a room in the Maldives or in Ethiopia or in Peru or something with people who are doing this work and who are willing to do it in this global, even though it's not their fault, even though it's not their problem, even though they could just as easily just be angry at the rest of us. Instead, they've chosen this kind of path of some kind of solidarity. It's always a privilege. It's a great privilege for me to be here tonight. Great honor to be here tonight with those of you who are doing this work already and with those of you who I hope will do it in the future. I cannot promise you that we are going to win. There are scientists who think that we've waited too long to get started, and there are political scientists who think the odds are simply too high and the power on the other side too great, and they may be right. If you are a betting person, you might be right to bet that we would lose, but you're not allowed to make that bet. The only moral position for someone alive at the moment when the worst thing that happened is happening is to try and do something to change those odds some. So I look forward just to working shoulder to shoulder with you in the years ahead to see what we can do. No guarantee of victory, only that we will fight hard all the way through. Thank you all very much.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to a speech I recorded at the University of British Columbia, Canada, with author, journalist, and climate activist Bill McKibben. You can download the full speech from April 9th, 2011, along with the Q&A as free MP3 files from our website at ecoshock.org. Look for our audio on demand menu right on the main page and choose climate change. To record this speech with good audio quality, I have to thank Mark Van Driel of webeventcast.com. And my thanks to the Vancouver Institute, which continues to bring important speakers to the city, open to the public for free. You can't beat that.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.